With Potapada, translated by Bhikkhu Sujato. So I have heard. At one time the Buddha was staying near Sarvati in Jeta's Grove, an Artapindika's monastery. Now at that time the wanderer Potapada was residing together with 300 wanderers in Malikar's single-halled monastery for group debates set among the flaking pale moon ebony trees. Then the Buddha robed up in the morning and, taking his bowl and robe, entered Sarvati for alms. Then it occurred to him, it's too early to wander for alms in Sarvati. Why don't I go to Malikar's monastery to visit the wanderer Potapada? So that's what he did. Now at that time, Potapada was sitting together with a large assembly of wanderers, making an uproar, a dreadful racket. They engaged in all kinds of unworthy talk, such as talk about kings, bandits and ministers, talk about armies, threats and wars, talk about food, drink, clothes and beds, talk about garlands and fragrances, talk about family, vehicles, villages, towns, cities and countries, talk about women and heroes, street talk and well talk about the departed, motley talk, tales of land and sea, and talk about being reborn in this or that state of existence. Potapada saw the Buddha coming off in the distance and hushed his own assembly. Be quiet, good sirs, don't make a sound. Here comes the ascetic Gotama. The Venerable likes quiet and praises quiet. Hopefully, if he sees that our assembly is quiet, he'll see fit to approach. Then those wanderers fell silent. Then the Buddha approached Potapada, who said to him, Come, Blessed One. Welcome, Blessed One. It's been a long time since you took the opportunity to come here. Please, sir, sit down. This seat is ready. The Buddha sat on the seat spread out, while Potapada took a low seat and sat to one side. The Buddha said to him, Potapada, what were you talking about just now? What conversation was unfinished? When he said this, the wanderer Potapada said to the Buddha, Sir, leave aside what we were sitting talking about just now. It won't be hard for you to hear about that later. Sir, a few days ago, several ascetics and Brahmins, who follow various other paths, were sitting together at the debating hall, and this discussion came up among them. How does the cessation of perception happen? Some of them said, A person's perceptions arise and cease without cause or reason. When they arise, you become percipient. When they cease, you become non-percipient. That's how some describe the cessation of perception. But someone else says, That's not how it is, gentlemen. Perception is a person's self. When it enters, you become percipient. When it departs, you become non-percipient. That's how some describe the cessation of perception. But someone else says, That's not how it is, gentlemen. There are ascetics and Brahmins of great power and might. They insert and extract a person's perception. When they insert it, you become percipient. When they extract it, you become non-percipient. That's how some describe the cessation of perception. But someone else says, That's not how it is, gentlemen. There are deities of great power and might. They insert and extract a person's perception. When they insert it, you become percipient. When they extract it, you become non-percipient. That's how some describe the cessation of perception. That reminded me of the Buddha. Surely it must be the Blessed One, the Holy One, who is so skilled in such matters. The Buddha is skilled and well-versed in the cessation of perception. How does the cessation of perception happen? Regarding this, Potapada, those ascetics and Brahmins who say that a person's perceptions arise and cease without cause or reason are wrong from the start. Why is that? because a person's perceptions arise and cease with cause and reason. With training, certain perceptions arise and certain perceptions cease. And what is that training? Said the Buddha. It's when a realized one arises in the world, perfected, a fully awakened Buddha, accomplished in knowledge and conduct, holy, knower of the world, supreme guide for those who wish to train, teacher of gods and humans, awakened, blessed. He has realized with his own insight this world, with its gods, Maras and Brahmas, this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, gods and humans, and he makes it known to others. He teaches Dhamma that's good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, meaningful and well-phrased, and he reveals a spiritual practice that's entirely full and pure. A householder hears that teaching, or a householder's child, or someone reborn in some clan. They gain faith in the realized one and reflect, living in a house is cramped and dirty, but the life of one gone forth is wide open. It's not easy for someone living at home to lead the spiritual life utterly full and pure, like a polished shell. Why don't I shave off my hair and beard, dress in ochre robes, and go forth from the lay life to homelessness? After some time, they give up a large or small fortune and a large or small family circle. They shave off hair and beard, dress in ochre robes, and go forth from the lay life to homelessness. Once they've gone forth, they live restrained in the monastic code, conducting themselves well and seeking alms in suitable places. Seeing danger in the slightest fault, they keep the rules they've undertaken. They act skillfully by body and speech. They're purified in livelihood and accomplished in ethical conduct. They guard the sense doors, have mindfulness and situational awareness, and are content. And how is a mendicant accomplished in ethics? It's when a mendicant gives up killing living creatures, renouncing the rod and the sword. They're scrupulous and kind, living full of compassion for all living beings. This pertains to their ethics. They give up stealing. They take only what's given and expect only what's given. They keep themselves clean by not thieving. This pertains to their ethics. They give up unchastity. They are celibate, set apart, avoiding the common practice of sex. This pertains to their ethics. They give up lying. They speak the truth and stick to the truth. They are honest and trustworthy and don't trick the world with their words. This pertains to their ethics. They give up divisive speech. They don't repeat in one place what they heard in another, so as to divide people against each other. Instead, they reconcile those who are divided, supporting unity, delighting in harmony, loving harmony, speaking words that promote harmony. This pertains to their ethics. They give up harsh speech. They speak in a way that's mellow, pleasing to the ear, lovely, going to the heart, polite, likeable and agreeable to the people. This pertains to their ethics. They give up talking nonsense. Their words are timely, true, and meaningful, in line with the teaching and training. They say things at the right time which are valuable, reasonable, succinct, and beneficial. This pertains to their ethics. They refrain from injuring plants and seeds. They eat in one part of the day, abstaining from eating at night and food at the wrong time. They avoid dancing, singing, music, and seeing shows. They refrain from beautifying and adorning themselves with garlands, fragrance, and makeup. They avoid high and luxurious beds. They avoid receiving gold and money, raw grains, raw meat, women and girls, male and female bond servants, goats and sheep, chickens and pigs, elephants, cows, horses, and mares, and fields, and land. They refrain from running errands and messages, buying and selling, falsifying weights, metals, or measures, bribery, fraud, cheating, and duplicity. mutilation, murder, abduction, banditry, plunder, and violence. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in injuring plants and seeds. These include plants propagated from roots, stems, cuttings, or joints, and those from regular seeds as the fifth. They refrain from such injury to plants and seeds. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in storing up goods for their own use. This includes such things as food, drink, clothes, vehicles, bedding, fragrance, and material possessions. They refrain from storing up such goods. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in seeing shows. This includes such things as dancing, singing, music, performances and storytelling, clapping, gongs and kettle drums, art exhibitions and acrobatic displays, battles of elephants, horses, buffaloes, bulls, goats, rams, chickens and quails, staff fights, boxing and wrestling, combat, roll calls of the armed forces, battle formations and regimental reviews. They refrain from such shows. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in gambling that causes negligence. This includes such things as checkers, draughts, checkers in the air, hopscotch, spillikins, board games, tip-cat, drawing straws, dice, leaf flutes, toy ploughs, somersaults, pinwheels, toy measures, toy carts, toy bows, guessing words from syllables, and guessing another's thoughts. They refrain from such gambling. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still make use of high and luxurious bedding. This includes such things as sofas, couches, woolen covers, shag-piled, colourful, white, embroidered with flowers, quilted, embroidered with animals, double or single-fringed, and silk covers studded with gems, as well as silken sheets, woven carpets, rugs for elephants, horses or chariots, antelope hide rugs, and spreads of fine deer hide with a canopy above and red cushions at both ends. They refrain from such bedding. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in beautifying and adorning themselves with garlands, fragrance, and makeup. This includes such things as applying beauty products by anointing, massaging, bathing, and rubbing, mirrors, ointments, garlands, fragrances, and makeup, face powder, foundation, bracelets, headbands, fancy walking sticks or containers, rapiers, parasols, fancy sandals, turbans, jewellery, chowries, and long-fringed white robes. They refrain from such beautification and adornment. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in unworthy talk. This includes such topics as talk about kings, bandits, and ministers, talk about armies, threats, and wars, talk about food, drink, clothes, and beds, talk about garlands and fragrances, talk about family, vehicles, villages, towns, cities, and countries, talk about women and heroes, street talk and well talk, talk about the departed, motley talk, tales of land and sea, and talk about being reborn in this or that state of existence. They refrain from such unworthy talk. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in arguments. They say such things as, "You don't understand this teaching and training. I understand this teaching and training. What, you understand this teaching and training? You're practicing wrong. I'm practicing right. I stay on topic, you don't. You said last what you should have said first. You said first what you should have said last. What you thought so much about has been disproved. Your doctrine is refuted. Go on, save your doctrine. You're trapped. Get yourself out of this if you can." They refrain from such argumentative talk. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in running errands and messages. This includes running errands for rulers, ministers, aristocrats, Brahmins, householders, or princes who say, "Go here, go there, take this, bring that from there." They refrain from such errands. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still engage in deceit, flattery, hinting, and belittling, and using material possessions to pursue other material possessions. They refrain from such deceit and flattery. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still earn a living by unworthy branches of knowledge, by wrong livelihood. This includes such fields as limb-reading, omenology, divining celestial portents, interpreting dreams, divining bodily marks, divining holes in cloth gnawed by mice, fire offerings, ladle offerings, offerings of husks, rice powder, rice, ghee, or oil, offerings from the mouth, blood sacrifices, palmistry, geomancy for building sites, fields and cemeteries, exorcisms, earth magic, snake charming, poisons, the crafts of the scorpion, the rat, the bird, and the crow, prophesying lifespan, chanting for protection, and animal cries. They refrain from such unworthy branches of knowledge, such wrong livelihood. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still earn a living by unworthy branches of knowledge, by wrong livelihood. This includes reading the marks of gems, cloth, clubs, swords, spears, arrows, weapons, women, men, boys, girls, male and female bondservants, elephants, horses, buffaloes, bulls, cows, goats, rams, chickens, quails, monitor lizards, rabbits, tortoises, or deer. They refrain from such unworthy branches of knowledge, such wrong livelihood. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still earn a living by unworthy branches of knowledge, by wrong livelihood. This includes making predictions that the king will march forth or march back, or that our king will attack and the enemy king will retreat, or vice versa, or that our king will triumph and the enemy king will be defeated, or vice versa. And so there will be victory for one and defeat for the other. They refrain from such unworthy branches of knowledge, such wrong livelihood. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still earn a living by unworthy branches of knowledge, by wrong livelihood. This includes making predictions that there will be an eclipse of the moon, or sun, or stars, that the sun, moon, and stars will be in conjunction or in opposition, that there will be a meteor shower, a fiery sky, an earthquake, thunder, that there will be a rising, a setting, a darkening, a brightening of the moon, sun, and stars. And it also includes making predictions about the results of all such phenomena. They refrain from such unworthy branches of knowledge, such wrong livelihood. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still earn a living by unworthy branches of knowledge, by wrong livelihood. This includes predicting whether there will be plenty of rain or drought, plenty to eat or famine, an abundant harvest or a bad harvest, security or peril, sickness or health. It also includes such occupations as computing, accounting, calculating, poetry, and cosmology. They refrain from such unworthy branches of knowledge, such wrong livelihood. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still earn a living by unworthy branches of knowledge, by wrong livelihood. This includes making arrangements for giving and taking in marriage, for engagement and divorce, and for scattering rice inwards or outwards at the wedding ceremony. It also includes casting spells for good or bad luck, curses to prevent conception, bind the tongue or lock the jaws, charms for the hands and ears, questioning a mirror, a girl or a god as an oracle, worshipping the sun, worshipping the Great One, breathing fire, and invoking Siri, the goddess of luck. They refrain from such unworthy branches of knowledge, such wrong livelihood. This pertains to their ethics. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who, while enjoying food given in faith, still earn a living by unworthy branches of knowledge, by wrong livelihood. This includes rites for propitiation, for granting wishes, for ghosts, for the earth, for rain, for property settlement, and for preparing and consecrating house sites, and rites involving rinsing and bathing, and oblations. It also includes administering emetics, purgatives, expectorants, and phlemagogues, administering ear oils, eye restoratives, nasal medicine, ointments, and counter-ointments, surgery with needle and scalpel, treating children, prescribing root medicines, and binding on herbs. They refrain from such unworthy branches of knowledge, such wrong livelihood. This pertains to their ethics. A mendicant thus accomplished in ethics sees no danger in any quarter in regards to their ethical restraint. It's like a king who has defeated his enemies. He sees no danger from his foes in any quarter. In the same way, a mendicant thus accomplished in ethics sees no danger in any quarter in regards to their ethical restraint. When they have this entire spectrum of noble ethics, they experience a blameless happiness inside themselves. That's how a mendicant is accomplished in ethics. And how does a mendicant guard the sense doors? When a noble disciple sees a sight with their eyes, they don't get caught up in the features and details. If the faculty of sight were left unrestrained, bad, unskillful qualities of desire and aversion would become overwhelming. For this reason, they practice restraint, protecting the faculty of sight and achieving its restraint. When they hear a sound with their ears, they don't get caught up in the features and details. If the faculty of hearing were left unrestrained, bad, unskillful qualities of desire and aversion would become overwhelming. For this reason, they practice restraint, protecting the faculty of hearing and achieving its restraint. When they smell an odour with their nose, they don't get caught up in the features and details. If the faculty of smell were left unrestrained, bad, unskillful qualities of desire and aversion would become overwhelming. For this reason, they practice restraint, protecting the faculty of smell and achieving its restraint. When they taste a flavour with their tongue, they don't get caught up in the features and details. If the faculty of taste were left unrestrained, bad, unskillful qualities of desire and aversion would become overwhelming. For this reason, they practice restraint, protecting the faculty of taste and achieving its restraint. When they feel a touch with their body, they don't get caught up in the features and details. If the faculty of touch were left unrestrained, bad, unskillful qualities of desire and aversion would become overwhelming. For this reason, they practice restraint, protecting the faculty of touch and achieving its restraint. When they know a thought with their mind, they don't get caught up in the features and details. If the faculty of mind were left unrestrained, bad, unskillful qualities of desire and aversion would become overwhelming. For this reason, they practice restraint, protecting the faculty of mind and achieving its restraint. When they have this noble sense restraint, they experience an unsullied bliss inside themselves. That's how a mendicant guards the sense doors. And how does a mendicant have mindfulness and situational awareness? It's when a mendicant acts with situational awareness, when going out and coming back, when looking ahead and aside, when bending and extending the limbs, when bearing the outer robe, bowl and robes, when eating, drinking, chewing and tasting, when urinating and defecating, when walking, standing, sitting, sleeping, waking, speaking and keeping silent. That's how a mendicant has mindfulness and situational awareness. And how is a mendicant content? It's when a mendicant is content with robes to look after the body and alms food to look after the belly. Wherever they go, they set out taking only these things. They're like a bird. Wherever it flies, wings are its only burden. In the same way, a mendicant is content with robes to look after the body and alms food to look after the belly. Wherever they go, they set out taking only these things. That's how a mendicant is content. When they have this noble spectrum of ethics, this noble sense restraint, this noble mindfulness and situational awareness, and this noble contentment, they frequent a secluded lodging, a wilderness, the root of a tree, a hill, a ravine, a mountain cave, a charnel ground, a forest, the open air, a heap of straw. After the meal, they return from arms round, sit down cross-legged with their body straight, and establish mindfulness right there. Giving up desire for the world, they meditate with the heart rid of desire, cleansing the mind of desire. Giving up ill will and malevolence, they meditate with a mind rid of ill will, full of compassion for all living beings, cleansing the mind of ill will. Giving up dullness and drowsiness, they meditate with a mind rid of dullness and drowsiness, perceiving light, mindful and aware, cleansing the mind of dullness and drowsiness. Giving up restlessness and remorse, they meditate without restlessness, their mind peaceful inside, cleansing the mind of restlessness and remorse. Giving up doubt, they meditate having gone beyond doubt, not undecided about skillful qualities, cleansing the mind of doubt. Suppose a man who has gotten into debt were to apply himself to work and his efforts proved successful. He would pay off the original loan and have enough left over to support his partner. Thinking about this, he'd be filled with joy and happiness. Suppose there was a person who was sick, suffering, gravely ill. They'd lose their appetite and get physically weak. But after some time, they'd recover from that illness and regain their appetite and their strength. Thinking about this, they'd be filled with joy and happiness. Suppose a person was imprisoned in a jail, but after some time, they were released from jail, safe and sound, with no loss of wealth. Thinking about this, they'd be filled with joy and happiness. Suppose a person was a bond servant. They belonged to someone else and were unable to go where they wish. But after some time they'd be freed from servitude and become their own master, an emancipated individual able to go where they wish. Thinking about this, they'd be filled with joy and happiness. Suppose there was a person with wealth and property who was travelling along a desert road which was perilous, with nothing to eat. But after some time, they crossed over the desert safely, reaching the neighbourhood of a village, a sanctuary free of peril. Thinking about this, they'd be filled with joy and happiness. In the same way, as long as these five hindrances are not given up inside themselves, A mendicant regards them thus as a debt, a disease, a prison, slavery, and a desert crossing. But when these five hindrances are given up inside themselves, a mendicant regards this as freedom from debt, good health, release from prison, emancipation, and sanctuary. Seeing that the hindrances have been given up in them, joy springs up. Being joyful, rapture springs up. When the mind is full of rapture, the body becomes tranquil. When the body is tranquil, they feel bliss. And when blissful, the mind becomes immersed. Quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unskillful qualities, they enter and remain in the first absorption, which has the rapture and bliss born of seclusion while placing the mind and keeping it connected. The sensual perception that they had previously ceases. At that time, they have a subtle and true perception of the rapture and bliss born of seclusion. That's how, with training, certain perceptions arise and certain perceptions cease. And this is that training, said the Buddha. Furthermore, as the placing of the mind and keeping it connected are stilled, a mendicant enters and remains in the second absorption, which has the rapture and bliss born of immersion, with internal clarity and confidence and unified mind, without placing the mind and keeping it connected. The subtle and true perception of the rapture and bliss born of seclusion that they had previously ceases. At that time, they have a subtle and true perception of the rapture and bliss born of immersion. That's how, with training, certain perceptions arise and certain perceptions cease. And this is that training, said the Buddha. Furthermore, with a fading away of rapture, a mendicant enters and remains in the third absorption, where they meditate with equanimity, mindful and aware, personally experiencing the bliss of which the noble ones declare, equanimous and mindful, one meditates in bliss. The subtle and true perception of the rapture and bliss born of immersion that they had previously ceases. At that time, they have a subtle and true perception of equanimous bliss. That's how, with training, certain perceptions arise and certain perceptions cease. And this is that training, said the Buddha. Furthermore, giving up pleasure and pain and ending former happiness and sadness, a mendicant enters and remains in the fourth absorption, without pleasure or pain, with pure equanimity and mindfulness. The subtle and true perception of equanimous bliss that they had previously ceases. At that time they have a subtle and true perception of neutral feeling. That's how, with training, certain perceptions arise and certain perceptions cease. And this is that training, said the Buddha. Furthermore, a mendicant, going totally beyond perceptions of form, with the ending of perceptions of impingement, not focusing on perceptions of diversity, aware that space is infinite, enters and remains in the dimension of infinite space. The perception of luminous form that they had previously ceases. At that time they have a subtle and true perception of the dimension of infinite space. That's how, with training, certain perceptions arise and certain perceptions cease. And this is that training, said the Buddha. Furthermore, a mendicant, going totally beyond the dimension of infinite space, aware that consciousness is infinite, enters and remains in the dimension of infinite consciousness. The subtle and true perception of the dimension of infinite space that they had previously ceases. At that time they have a subtle and true perception of the dimension of infinite consciousness. That's how, with training, certain perceptions arise and certain perceptions cease. And this is that training, said the Buddha. Furthermore, a mendicant, going totally beyond the dimension of infinite consciousness, aware that there is nothing at all, enters and remains in the dimension of nothingness. The subtle and true perception of the dimension of infinite consciousness that they had previously ceases. At that time, they have a subtle and true perception of the dimension of nothingness. That's how, with training, certain perceptions arise and certain perceptions cease. And this is that training, said the Buddha. Potapada, from the time a mendicant here takes responsibility for their own perception, they proceed from one stage to the next, gradually reaching the peak of perception. Standing on the peak of perception, they think, intentionality is bad for me, it's better to be free of it, for if I were to intend and choose, these perceptions would cease in me, and other coarser perceptions would arise. Why don't I neither make a choice nor form an intention? They neither make a choice nor form an intention. Those perceptions cease in them, and other coarser perceptions don't arise. They touch cessation. And that, Potapada, is how the gradual cessation of perception is attained with awareness. What do you think, Potapada? Have you ever heard of this before? No, sir. This is how I understand what the Buddha said. From the time a mendicant here takes responsibility for their own perception, they proceed from one stage to the next, gradually reaching the peak of perception. Standing on the peak of perception, they think, intentionality is bad for me, it's better to be free of it, for if I were to intend and choose, these perceptions would cease in me and other coarser perceptions would arise. Why don't I neither make a choice nor form an intention? Those perceptions cease in them and other coarser perceptions don't arise. They touch cessation. And that is how the gradual cessation of perception is attained with awareness. That's right, Potapada. Does the Buddha describe just one peak of perception or many? I describe the peak of perception as both one and many. But, sir, how do you describe it as one peak and as many? I describe the peak of perception according to the specific manner in which one touches cessation. That's how I describe the peak of perception as both one and many. But, sir, does perception arise first and knowledge afterwards? Or does knowledge arise first and perception afterwards? Or do they both arise at the same time? Perception arises first and knowledge afterwards. The arising of perception leads to the arising of knowledge. They understand, my knowledge arose from a specific condition. That is a way to understand how perception arises first and knowledge afterwards. That the arising of perception leads to the arising of knowledge. Sir, is perception a person's self, or are perception and self different things? But Potapada, do you believe in a self? I believe in a substantial self, sir, which is physical, made up of the four primary elements and consumes solid food. Suppose there were such a substantial self, Potapada. In that case, perception would be one thing, the self another. Here is another way to understand how perception and self are different things. So long as that substantial self remains, still some perceptions arise in a person and others cease. That is a way to understand how perception and self are different things. Sir, I believe in a mind-made self which is complete in all its various parts, not deficient in any faculty. Suppose there were such a mind-made self, Potapada. In that case, perception would be one thing, the self another. Here is another way to understand how perception and self are different things. So long as that mind-made self remains, still some perceptions arise in a person and others cease. That, too, is a way to understand how perception and self are different things. Sir, I believe in a non-physical self which is made of perception. Suppose there were such a non-physical self, Potapada. In that case, perception would be one thing, the self another. Here is another way to understand how perception and self are different things. So long as that non-physical self remains, still some perceptions arise in a person and others cease. That, too, is a way to understand how perception and self are different things. But, sir, am I able to know whether perception is a person's self, or whether perception and self are different things? It's hard for you to understand this, since you have a different view, creed, preference, practice, and tradition. Well, if that's the case, sir, then is this right? The cosmos is eternal. This is the only truth. Anything else is wrong. This has not been declared by me, Potapada. Then is this right? The cosmos is not eternal. This is the only truth. Anything else is wrong. This too has not been declared by me. Then is this right? The cosmos is finite. This is the only truth. Anything else is wrong. This too has not been declared by me. Then is this right? The cosmos is infinite. This is the only truth, and anything else is wrong. This too has not been declared by me. Then is this right? The soul and the body are the same thing. This is the only truth. Anything else is wrong. This too has not been declared by me. Then is this right? The soul and the body are different things. This is the only truth. Anything else is wrong. This too has not been declared by me. Then is this right? A realized one exists after death. This is the only truth. Anything else is wrong. This too has not been declared by me. Then is this right? A realized one doesn't exist after death. This is the only truth. Anything else is wrong. This too has not been declared by me. Then is this right? A realized one both exists and doesn't exist after death. This is the only truth. Anything else is wrong. This too has not been declared by me. Then is this right? A realized one neither exists nor doesn't exist after death. This is the only truth. Anything else is wrong. This too has not been declared by me. Why haven't these things been declared by the Buddha? Because they're not beneficial or relevant to the fundamentals of the spiritual life. They don't lead to disillusionment, dispassion, cessation, peace, insight, awakening, and extinguishment. That's why I haven't declared them. Then what has been declared by the Buddha? I have declared this. This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the practice that leads to the cessation of suffering. Why have these things been declared by the Buddha? Because they are beneficial and relevant to the fundamentals of spiritual life. They lead to disillusionment, dispassion, cessation, peace, insight, awakening, and extinguishment. That's why I have declared them. That's so true, Blessed One. That's so true, Holy One. Please, sir, go at your convenience. Then the Buddha got up from his seat and left. Soon after the Buddha left, those wanderers gave Potapada a comprehensive tongue-lashing. No matter what the ascetic Gotama says, Potapada agrees with him. That's so true, Blessed One. That's so true, Holy One. We understand that the ascetic Gotama didn't make any definitive statement at all regarding whether the cosmos is eternal, and so on. When they said this, Potapada said to them, I too understand that the ascetic Gotama didn't make any definitive statement at all regarding whether the cosmos is eternal, and so on. Nevertheless, the practice that he describes is true, real, and accurate. It is the regularity of natural principles, the invariance of natural principles. So how could a sensible person such as I not agree that what was well spoken by the ascetic Gotama was in fact well spoken? Then after 2 or 3 days had passed, Citta, Hatisariputta and Potapada went to see the Buddha. Citta, Hatisariputta bowed and sat down to one side. But the wanderer Potapada exchanged greetings with the Buddha, and when the greetings and polite conversation were over, he sat down to one side. Potapada told the Buddha what had happened after he left. The Buddha said, All those wanderers, Potapada, are blind and sightless. You are the only one who sees. For I have taught and pointed out both things that are definitive and things that are not definitive. And what things have I taught and pointed out that are not definitive? The cosmos is eternal. The cosmos is not eternal. The cosmos is finite. The cosmos is infinite. The soul is the same thing as the body. The soul and the body are different things. A realized one exists after death. A realized one doesn't exist after death. A realized one both exists and doesn't exist after death. A realized one neither exists nor doesn't exist after death. And why haven't I taught and pointed out such things that are not definitive? Because those things aren't beneficial or relevant to the fundamentals of the spiritual life. They don't lead to disillusionment, dispassion, cessation, peace, insight, awakening, and extinguishment. That's why I haven't taught and pointed them out. And what things have I taught and pointed out that are definitive? This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the practice that leads to the cessation of suffering. And why have I taught and pointed out such things that are definitive? Because they are beneficial and relevant to the fundamentals of the spiritual life. They lead to disillusionment, dispassion, cessation, peace, insight, awakening, and extinguishment. That's why I have taught and pointed them out. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who have this doctrine and view: the self is exclusively happy and is sound after death. I go up to them and say, "Is it really true that this is the Venerable's view?" And they answer, "Yes." I say to them, "But do you meditate knowing and seeing an exclusively happy world?" Asked this, they say, "No." I say to them, "But have you perceived an exclusively happy self for a single day or night, or even half a day or night?" Asked this, they say, "No." I say to them, "But do you know a path and a practice to realize an exclusively happy world?" Asked this, they say, "No." I say to them, "But have you ever heard the voice of the deities reborn in an exclusively happy world saying, 'Practice well, dear sirs, practice directly so as to realize an exclusively happy world, for this is how we practiced, and we were reborn in an exclusively happy world'?" Asked this, they say, "No." What do you think, Potapada? This being so, doesn't what they say turn out to have no demonstrable basis? Clearly that's the case, sir. Suppose, Potapada, a man were to say, "Whoever the finest lady in the land is, it is her that I want, her that I desire." They say to him, "Mister, that finest lady in the land who you desire, do you know whether she's an aristocrat, a Brahmin, a merchant, or a worker?" Asked this, he'd say, "No." They'd say to him, "Mister, that finest lady in the land who you desire, do you know her name or clan, whether she's tall or short or medium, whether her skin is black, brown or tawny, what village, town or city she comes from?" Asked this, he'd say, "No." They'd say to him, "Mister, do you desire someone who you've never even known or seen?" Asked this, he'd say, "Yes." What do you think, Potapada? This being so, doesn't that man's statement turn out to have no demonstrable basis? Clearly that's the case, sir. In the same way, the ascetics and Brahmins who have those various doctrines and views, doesn't what they say turn out to have no demonstrable basis? Clearly that's the case, sir. Suppose a man was to build a ladder at the crossroads for climbing up to a stilt longhouse. They'd say to him, "Mister, that stilt longhouse that you're building a ladder for, do you know whether it's to the north, south, east or west, or whether it's tall or short or medium?" Asked this, he'd say, "No." They'd say to him, "Mister, are you building a ladder for a longhouse that you've never even known or seen?" Asked this, he'd say, "Yes." What do you think, Potapada? This being so, doesn't that man's statement turn out to have no demonstrable basis? Clearly that's the case, sir. In the same way, the ascetics and Brahmins who have those various doctrines and views, doesn't what they say turn out to have no demonstrable basis? Clearly that's the case, sir. Potapada, there are these three kinds of reincarnation: a substantial reincarnation, a mind-made reincarnation, and a non-physical reincarnation. And what is a substantial reincarnation? It is physical, made up of the four primary elements and consumes solid food. What is a mind-made reincarnation? It is physical, mind-made, complete in all its various parts, not deficient in any faculty. What is a non-physical reincarnation? It is non-physical, made of perception. I teach the Dhamma for the giving up of these three kinds of reincarnation. When you practice accordingly, corrupting qualities will be given up in you and cleansing qualities will grow. You'll enter and remain in the fullness and abundance of wisdom, having realized it with your own insight in this very life. Potapada, you might think, corrupting qualities will be given up and cleansing qualities will grow. One will enter and remain in the fullness and abundance of wisdom, having realized it with one's own insight in this very life. But such a life is suffering. But you should not see it like this. Corrupting qualities will be given up and cleansing qualities will grow. One will enter and remain in the fullness and abundance of wisdom, having realized it with one's own insight in this very life. And there will be only joy and happiness, tranquility, mindfulness, and awareness. Such a life is blissful. If others should ask us, "But reverends, what is that substantial reincarnation?" we'd answer like this: "This is that substantial reincarnation." If others should ask us, "But reverends, what is that mind-made reincarnation?" we'd answer like this: "This is that mind-made reincarnation." If others should ask us, "But reverends, what is that non-physical reincarnation?" we'd answer like this: "This is that non-physical reincarnation." What do you think, Potapada? This being so, doesn't that statement turn out to have a demonstrable basis? Certainly that's the case, sir. Suppose a man were to build a ladder for climbing up to a stilt longhouse right underneath that longhouse. They'd say to him, "Mister, that stilt longhouse that you're building a ladder for, do you know whether it's to the north, south, east or west, or whether it's tall or short or medium?" He'd say, "This is that stilt longhouse for which I'm building a ladder, right underneath it." What do you think, Potapada? This being so, doesn't that statement turn out to have a demonstrable basis? Clearly that's the case, sir. When the Buddha had spoken, Cittahati Sariputta said, "Sir, while in a substantial reincarnation, are the mind-made and non-physical reincarnations fictitious, and only the substantial reincarnation real? While in a mind-made reincarnation, are the substantial and non-physical reincarnations fictitious, and only the mind-made reincarnation real? While in a non-physical reincarnation, are the substantial and mind-made reincarnations fictitious, and only the non-physical reincarnation real? While in a substantial reincarnation, it's not referred to as a mind-made or non-physical reincarnation, only as a substantial reincarnation. While in a mind-made reincarnation, it's not referred to as a substantial or non-physical reincarnation, only as a mind-made reincarnation. While in a non-physical reincarnation, it's not referred to as a substantial or mind-made reincarnation, only as a non-physical reincarnation." Chitta, suppose they were to ask you, "Do you exist in the past? Will you exist in the future? Do you exist now?" how would you answer? "Sir, if they were to ask me this, I'd answer like this: I existed in the past. I will exist in the future. I exist now." That's how I'd answer. But Chitta, Suppose they were to ask you, is the reincarnation you had in the past your only real one, and those of the future and present fictitious? Is the reincarnation you will have in the future your only real one, and those of the past and present fictitious? Is the reincarnation you have now your only real one, and those of the past and future fictitious? How would you answer? Sir, if they were to ask me this, I'd answer like this. The reincarnation I had in the past was real at that time, and those of the future and present fictitious. The reincarnation I will have in the future will be real at that time, and those of the past and present fictitious. The reincarnation I have now is real at this time, and those of the past and future fictitious. That's how I'd answer. In the same way, while in any one of the three reincarnations, it's not referred to as the other two, only under its own name. From a cow comes milk, from milk comes curds, from curds come butter, from butter comes ghee, and from ghee comes cream of ghee. And the cream of ghee is said to be the best of these. While it's milk, it's not referred to as curds, butter, ghee, or cream of ghee. It's only referred to as milk. While it's curd, or butter, or ghee, or cream of ghee, it's not referred to as anything else, only under its own name. In the same way, while in any one of the three reincarnations, it's not referred to as the other two, only under its own name. These are the world's usages, terms, expressions, and descriptions which the realized one uses without misapprehending them. When he had spoken, the wanderer Potapada said to the Buddha, "Excellent, sir, excellent," as if he were writing the overturned or revealing the hidden or pointing out the path to the lost, or lighting a lamp in the dark so people with good eyes can see what's there, so too the Buddha has made the teaching clear in many ways. I go for refuge to the Buddha, to the teaching, and to the mendicant Sangha. From this day forth, may the Buddha remember me as a lay follower who has gone for refuge for life. But Cittahati Sariputta said to the Buddha, "Excellent, sir, excellent," as if he were writing the overturned or revealing the hidden, or pointing out the path to the lost, or lighting a lamp in the dark so people with good eyes can see what's there, so too the Buddha has made the teaching clear in many ways. I go for refuge to the Buddha, to the teaching, and to the mendicant Sangha. Sir, may I receive the going forth, the ordination in the Buddha's presence." And Cittahati Sariputta received the going forth, the ordination in the Buddha's presence. Not long after his ordination, Venerable Cittahati Sariputta, living alone, withdrawn, diligent, keen, and resolute, soon realized the supreme end of the spiritual path in this very life. He lived having achieved with his own insight the goal for which gentlemen rightly go forth from the lay life to homelessness. He understood, rebirth is ended, the spiritual journey has been completed, what had to be done has been done, there is no return to any state of existence. And Venerable Cittahati Sariputta became one of the perfected.